This is Daisy Uhas reading pages 104 to 107 of Charles Johnson's Middle Passage. The dogs were howling, a slobber like sea foam spilling from their mouths because Meadows was beating them viciously with a shambok. In the glow of a deck light, I could see he was wearing my clothes. The killing part was my blouse looked better on him than it in me. Lashing the ship's dogs, he spoke to them in an unerring imitation of Black English, his accent passably Southern Illinoisan, his speech sprinkled with my quirky rhetorical asides, which I swore, right then, I would never use again. For a moment I was fascinated. It was like watching a voodoo priest manipulating a lock of your hair, impaling a doll effigy of you with pins. Meadows even managed to mime a few of my physical eccentricities, like the way I tugged my right earlobe when perplexed. I caught myself doing it then, glanced back at him, and gasped, or sometimes rubbed my nose with a quick flick of my thumb, boxer style, gestures that were quintessentially Rutherford Calhoun, and delivered now to the frothing dogs with profound, heartless doses of pain. Meadows peeled off my clothing, let the hound smell and snap at it one last time, then he pulled a pair of Kringle's breeches over his own, rolling up the cuffs. Again he whipped them, wrenching his voice toward higher registers to sound like the master's mate giving orders. It laid me low, seeing Meadows vanish and a devastating caricature of Peter Kringle emerge, boiled down to his broad outlines. The barber surgeon was a born thespian. Knowing each mate medically, I guessed, gave him this gift for brutal satire. After rubbing the crotch of Kringle's smelly trousers into their noses to drive home his strongest scent, Meadows draped a few articles of brightly colored African dress, abopo and abada, around his broad waist, unleashed a new, stinging round of stripes, and spoke those haunting words the Amusiri men and women used, like a fragrance breathed into the air. For the dogs, though, these were hated words, intertwined with 20 lashes. They would throw themselves, fangs unsheathed, with no thought toward their safety, upon anyone speaking Amusiri, scratching his brow like Kringle, or blending the languages of house and field, street and seminary, as I often did. Fingers of sweat dripped from Meadows' face. His whipping arm was sore, and he rubbed it, then peered round in my direction. I pressed myself down between the topsail bit and foremast, the skin on my back crawling. He shrugged, picked up his laundry basket, and headed for the forecastle. Long minutes passed before I moved. My head went turn-giddy. I was unsure of what I had witnessed, but I knew what it meant. This was not a ship. It was a coffin. The morrow would bring catastrophe, because Meadows was one step ahead of the old man, giving a living weapon to Falcon's loyalists in case the mutineers seized the ship's guns or the Africans could not be controlled. Targeting Kringle to be torn apart, I understood. But why me? Were all loyalties here a lie? We would be sunk to the bottom of the briny unless, unbeknownst to these camps, someone played a trump, a hole card none knew existed. I realized that I held that card. Before doing anything, though, I needed to rest. To return to the galley, I was forced to maneuver slowly aft, over and around, human and nautical debris sprawled at the ship's waist, larboard side. The storm had flooded berths below, so several hands brought their gear topside to bed down in the open air beside slave women and children. Cluttered with bodies, wooden crates blown apart earlier, their contents strewn every which way, and draped with dangling sheets of sail, the sunken portion of the Republic, from tiller to stern, felt like a makeshift refugee camp, a smelly, chaotic strip of shantytown, where the injured and ailing were tossed helter-skelter together. In mist-softened light, mutineers, Africans, and able seamen could not be distinguished. Brief as this moment might be, no stations were evident among the ship's company. Could these people slay one another after sunrise, as some planned? It hardly seemed possible, or necessary. On the water, leagues from culture or civilization, I saw no point in perpetuating the lunacies of life on land. Just for a spell, the sea had swept some of that away. No one had the strength to sustain idols of the tribe or cave. Even the caged chickens were tired. Every so often, walls of spray faffled on deck, much in the fashion of showers I remembered in New Orleans during the spring that were refreshing and brief, and just as suddenly were gone. Our sails were asleep. Beneath a damp blanket, McGaffin slept beside the cabin boy. A Chinese mate and Ngonyama, who was officer of this night's watch, bandaged the arm of a boat puller bruised during the storm. Kringle dozed with Squibb's parrot on his left shoulder. His back was against the topgallant rail, both his eyes shuttered, and his head all on his right shoulder. I saw he was sweating. The armpits of his coat were stained, which was odd. Things were cooler now at Eight Bells, and since Meadows had left the pens, quiet but for an occasional cough and the sound of the ocean, sponge-like in the way it absorbed, even trivialized the noises we made.